The rest of the world decided that Abraham Lincoln was a great orator after his speech at Gettysburg. I realized it much earlier, when I heard him laying it over that gun-carrying ruffian who was breathing brimstone at him. I'll never forget that big, gangling body in the long coat that didn't quite fit, towering in the center of the hall with the big hands motionless at his sides. God knows how he had the nerve, with six armed men in front of him. But when I think back to it, and hear that hard, rasping drawl sounding in my memory, and remember the force in those eyes, I wonder how Buck had the nerve to stand up in front of him either. He did, though, for about half a minute, glaring from Lincoln to Cassie to me and back to Lincoln again. He was a brawny, violent man with a gun in his hands, but speaking objectively at a safe distance now. He has my sympathy. As a fellow bully and coward, I can say that Buck behaved precisely as I should have done in his place. He glared and breathed hard, but that was his limit. And then, through the open door came the distant sound of raised voices and a hurrying of many feet on the road. "I doubt that's the Kentucky militia," says Lincoln. "Better be going, Buck." With a curse, Buck swung about and stumped to the door. He turned again there, dark with passion, and pointed a shaking finger. "I'll be back. Don't you doubt it, mister. I'll be back, and I'll have the law with me." They clattered down the steps, and as the door closed and the exclamations started flying, Lincoln turned and looked down at me. "The ancients, in their wisdom, made a great study of rhetoric," says he. "But I wonder, did they ever envisage Buck Robinson?" "Yes, they probably did." He pursed his lips. "He's a big fellow, though. I think I'd sooner see Cicero square up to him behind a barn than me. Yes, I rather think I would." He adjusted his coat and cracked his knuckles. "And now, Mr. Comber." I've been wounded several times, all damned painful. But a ball in the bum is the worst. By the time that ham-fisted sawbones had hauled it out, I was weeping, and my immediate recuperation wasn't eased by the fact that Judge Payne and Lincoln agreed that Cassie and I must be spirited out of the house without delay, in case Buck and his friends returned with a warrant. With my buttocks in a sling, I was helped about half a mile to another establishment, where I gathered the folk were red-hot abolitionists, and put to bed face down. Of course, I had already given a rough account of what had happened in answer to the questions they fired at me. The judge was full of praise, while his wife, the ugly little woman, and the other females made much of Cassie and clucked over her cuts and bruises. But when they had taken us to the new house, Lincoln, very patient, begged our hosts for a little time alone with me. So they left us, and he sat down beside the bed. "Now, sir," says he, pointing that formidable head of his at me. "I parted from a respectable British naval officer in Washington. Tonight, I meet the wounded fugitive running an escaped slave across the Ohio. I'm not only curious, you understand. I'm a legislator of my country, a maker and a guardian of its laws, which, on your behalf, I suspect I have broken fairly comprehensively this night. I feel I am entitled to an explanation. Pray, begin, Mr. Comber." So I did. There was no point in lying much. He would have seen through it. So from New Orleans on, I told him the truth. Crixus, Randolph, the steamboat, the Mandevilles, the slave cart, and Cassie. I kept out the spicy bits, of course, and Mandeville's barbarous treatment of me I explained by pretending that Omohundro had turned up at Greystone's with searchers and identified me. That was how they treated Underground Railroad men in the South, I said.